These people were actors. After a while, the concentration level among the viewers had Doc feeling a little restless. He realized the scope of the mental damage one push on the off button of a TV zapper could inflict on this room full of obsessives. Luckily, he was near the door and managed to crawl out without anybody noticing. He hadn't seen Coy Harlingen around here yet, and figured this would be as good a time as any to go looking. He began to wander the great old house. The sun went down. The groupies flocked together briefly, transitioning into nighttime mode. Dinas ran around like a dog chasing pigeons in the park, snapping pictures, and girls obligingly scattered, going, "Ooh, ooh." Something like a security detail appeared now and then, out on the property making perimeter checks. From an upper window came the sound of Spotted Dick's keyboard player, Smedley, doing Hannon exercises on his Farfisa, a little combo compact model he had obtained on the advice of Rick Wright of Pink Floyd, and which was never observed far from his person. He called it Fiona, and witnesses had reported him having long conversations with it. Earlier, Doc, pretending to interview him for Stone Turntable, asked what they talked about.
"Oh, what you'd expect, association football, the war in Southeast Asia, where one can score sort of thing."
"And how's Fiona enjoying it here in Southern California?" Smedley got glum.
"Loves everything but the paranoia, man."
"Paranoia, really?"
His voice dropped to a whisper.
"This house."
At which point a scowling young gent, maybe one of the board's roadies, maybe not, entered and leaned against a wall with his arms folded, and just stayed there, listening. Smedley, his eyeballs oscillating wildly, fled the area. A private eye didn't drop acid for years in this town without picking up some kind of extrasensory chops, and truth was, since crossing the door sill of this place, Doc couldn't help noticing what you'd call an atmosphere. Instead of a ritual handshake or even a smile, everybody he got introduced to greeted him with the same formula, "Where are you at, man?" suggesting a high level of discomfort, even fear, about anybody who couldn't be dropped in a bag right away and labeled. This seemed to be happening more and more lately out in Greater Los Angeles, among gatherings of carefree youth and happy dopers, where Doc had begun to notice older men, there and not there, rigid, unsmiling, that he knew he'd seen before. Not the faces necessarily, but a defiant posture, an unwillingness to blur out, like everybody else at the psychedelic events of those days, beyond official envelopes of skin. Like the operatives who dragged away Coy Harlingen the other night at that rally at the Century Plaza. Doc knew these people. He'd seen enough of them in the course of business. They went out to collect cash debts. They broke rib cages. They got people fired. They kept an unforgiving eye on anything that might become a threat. If everything in this dream of pre-revolution was in fact doomed to end, and the faithless, money-driven world to reassert its control over all the lives it felt entitled to touch, fondle and molest, it would be agents like these, dutiful and silent, outdoing the shitwork who'd make it happen. Was it possible that at every gathering, concert, peace rally, love-in, be-in, and freak-in, here, up north, back east, wherever, those dark crews had been busy all along, reclaiming the music, the resistance to power, the sexual desire from epic to everyday, all they could sweep up for the ancient forces of greed and fear?
"Gee," he said to himself out loud, "I don't know."
At which point he ran into Jade,
just coming out of one of the bathrooms. What? You again?
Drove up with Bambi. She heard that Spotted Dick was staying here, so I had to come along, try and keep her out of trouble.
Into these folks, is she?
Spotted Dick blacklight posters on the wall. Spotted Dick sheets and pillowcases on the bed. Spotted Dick t-shirts, coffee cups, souvenir roach clips. And 24 hours a day Spotted Dick albums on the stereo. Man. You know this English ukulele player named George Formby?
Sure. Herman's Hermits covered one of his hits.
Well, these guys have covered everything else. I try to be cool with it. Spotted Dick are also known to be into some weird forms of recreation, and I think that's the main attraction for Bambi.
Haven't seen her around tonight.
Oh, she already split with the lead guitar. They're on the way up to Leo Carrillo looking for some cricket game.
Night cricket?
Yeah. Somerset told her it was like baseball, lights and so forth. Unless, oh no, do you think they're running a number on me?
Well, if you do need a ride back, let me know. And if anybody asks, I'm a rock and roll reporter, okay?
You?
Sure. I'll tell them about your Pat Boone cover interview. Oh, and hey, that guy I was talking to at the Club Asiatique the other night, you seen him around?
He's here someplace. Try the rehearsal rooms upstairs.
Sure enough, wandering the hallways, Doc heard the sound of a tenor sax practicing Donna Lee. He waited for a break and put his head in the room.
Howdy, it's me again. Remember that chore he wanted me to do? Wait.
Coy angled his thumb at a cluster of sound equipment over in the corner that may have had more wires than necessary running in and out of it, and he shook his head.
What was the, make and model you looked at again?
Doc went along.
You were asking about an older type VW, flowers and bluebirds and hearts and shit all over it? That's the one I was interested in, all right. No, Coy paused, improvising. No new replacement parts, nothing like that?
None I could see.
Street legal, no hassles with the registration?
Seemed that way.
Well, thanks for looking into that, you know. I just wondered the way people do.
Sure, any time.
Any other rides you want me to check out, just let me know.
Coy was quiet for a while. Doc thought about reaching over and poking him. A look on his face so desperate, so longing, and way too nervous, as if somehow inside this house he had actually been forbidden to speak. Doc wanted to lay at least a quick abrazo on this guy. Some reassurance. But that could be read by inquiring eyes as more emotion than anybody should invest in a used car deal.
You have my number, right? I'll be in touch.
Just then a driveling of dopers burst into the room, any of whom could have been assigned a spy on Coy. Doc unfocused his eyes and allowed his face to sag into a loose grin, and next time he looked, Coy was invisible, though he might have still been in the room. Back downstairs, a member of the company was going around jovially handing out joints. As people lit up and inhaled, he'd go, "Hey, guess what's in this grass?"
"No idea."
"Come on, guess."
"LSD?"
"No,
it's just grass." "Ha ha ha ha."
Approaching somebody else, "Hey, what do you think's in this dope we're smoking?"
"I don't know. Mescaline?"
"No, nothing. Pure grass. Ha ha, ha ha." And so forth.
Shredded psilocybe mushrooms? Angel dust? Speed?
No, just marijuana. Ha ha, ha ha.
Almost before Doc knew it, he'd gotten so stoned on the mystery weed that he flashed how it wasn't just Coy whose vital signs were debatable. Somebody had definitely been out harrowing the next world for board's personnel, because Doc knew now, beyond all doubt, that every single one of these boards was a zombie, undead and unclean.
Dead and clean is okay?
Dinas, who had materialized from someplace, wondered.
And that spotted dick, they're zombies too, only worse. Worse? English zombies. Look at them, man. American zombies are at least out front about it. Tend to stagger when they try to walk anywhere, usually in third ballet position, and they go like, with that rising and falling tone. Whereas English zombies are for the most part quite well spoken. They use long words and they glide everywhere like, sometimes you don't even see them take steps. It's like they're on ice skates.
At which point Spotted Dick's bass player, Trevor Shiny Mac McNutley, with a loose smile on his face, and pursuing a confused young woman, entered in exactly this way, crossing smoothly from left to right.
You see? You see? Ah!
Dinas running off in panic.
I'm out of here, man!
Dinas having failed to provide him much of an anchor in reality, Doc now proceeded to freak even further out. That dope, with its extra ingredient, which might not really have been there, could also have had something to do with it. Howsoever, Doc suddenly found himself fleeing through the corridors of the creepy old mansion with uncertain numbers of screaming, flesh-eating creatures behind him. Down in the vast kitchen, he ran pretty much head-on into Dinas again, now busy looting the fridge and cabinets and filling a Safeway bag with cookies, frozen candy bars, Cheetos, and other munchies of opportunity.
Come on, Dinas, we gotta split. Tell me about it, man. I snapped a picture a couple minutes ago and they all went insane trying to take away my camera, and now they're after me, so I figured I better grab what I can. Actually, man, I think I hear them.
Doc, guiding Dinas by the string of love beads around his neck, dragged him out a side exit into the grounds.
Come on!
They started running for where they'd parked the car.
Geez, Doc, you said free dope, maybe some chicks. You didn't say nothing about no zombies, man.
Dinas, advised Doc, already out of breath.
Just run!
Passing a sycamore tree, he was unexpectedly descended on by somebody who'd been trying to hang on to a branch. It was Jade, in a state of panic.
What am I, the skipper? Doc muttering onto his feet again. Or some shit? I really need a ride out of here, Jade said. Please!
By some piece of luck, they found Doc's car right where he'd parked it, and they piled in and went screeching out down the driveway. In the mirror, Doc saw dark shapes with ghostly white incisors slithering into a 1949 Mercury Woody with a front end and split windshield that looked like the snout and pitiless eyes of a predator, which now came after them. Its V8 in a throbbing roar, gravel scattering off the driveway. At the canyon road, Doc hooked a violent left, nearly rolling them over and fishtailing once or twice before straightening out and proceeding down to Malibu, on what in those days was not quite the multiple-lane suburban convenience it would later become. More, you'd say, of a life-threatening nightmare, actually, full of blind driveways and serious hairpins, where Doc soon found himself putting to good use his refresher courses at the well-known Tex Winer École de Pilotage, executing four-wheel drifts and more heel and toe double-clutching than fully foreseen by the design teams back at Chrysler Motors, while the radio played Here Comes the Hodads by the Marquettes. Dinas, despite the 3D jolting around he was getting, sat good-naturedly putting together a joint without hardly spilling anything, lighting and presenting it to Jade once they were all the way downhill and headed for Santa Monica.
"Nicely rolled, Dinas," Doc remarked when it came his way at last. "Don't know if I'd have had the presence of mind myself. Basically just trying to keep from freaking out."
"Listen, Doc," Jade said, "what is it with that guy from the Club Asiatique?"
"Coy Harlingen. You talked to him?"
"Yes. And when they found us together, it really looked like somebody meant to do me some harm. Not like I was trying to seduce him. Normally, if Bambi's around, I don't worry when they come after me like that. But she was off at that night cricket, so it's a blessing you guys showed up when you did."
"Our pleasure," Dinas assured her.
At some point, after they were back on the coast highway and heading for the freeway, Doc glanced in the rear-view mirror and no longer saw the headlights of the sinister Woody behind him. Like a once troublesome pair of zits on the face of the night, they had faded away. What he couldn't also help noticing in the mirror now was that Dinas and Jade were striking up a friendship.
"And what's, like, your name?" Dinas was saying.
"Ashley," said Jade.
"Not Jade?" Doc said.
"My working name. In the Fairfax High Yearbook, I'm just one of, like, 1,000 Ashleys."
"And the Chick Planet Salon?"
"Never considered that a career. Too fucking wholesome. Smiling all the time. Pretending it's about vibrations or self-awareness or anything, but..."
Sliding upward into an old movie society lady screech,
"Huddable fucking."
"Southern California," Dinas chimed in. "No sympathy for weirdness, man. None of them Docker-type activities."
"Yeah, really, like, where's that at?" Jade or Ashley sympathized.
"And people wonder why Charlie Manson's the way he is."
"Do you eat pussy, by the way?"
They entered the transition tunnel to the eastbound Santa Monica freeway, where the radio, which had been playing The Birds 8 miles High, lost the signal. Doc kept singing it to himself, and when they emerged and the sound came back, he was no more than half a bar off.
"Dinas, don't forget to leave me the camera, okay?"
In eloquent silence.
"Dinas?"
"He's busy," Jade murmured.
Remaining so all the way to the Harbor Freeway, to the Hollywood Freeway, and up over the Cahuenga Pass to Jade's exit, in the course of which, in a very relaxed, occasionally drowsy voice, pausing every once in a while to send Dinas down a word of encouragement, she filled Doc in on her early history of experimenting with shoplifting and Grand Theft Auto. She had met up with Bambi in dormitory 8000 at Sybil Brand Institute, where Bambi, observing Jade one evening furiously masturbating, offered to do her pussy for a pack of smokes, menthol if possible.
"Sure thing."
Jade by this point was desperate enough to chirp back. Next time, lights out arriving not a moment too soon, Bambi had brought the price down to half a pack. Then, on her knees, much more thoughtful now, she found herself offering to pay Jade.
"I guess," Jade said, "we could call it one token cigarette, though I'm not real comfortable even with, oh, Bambi."
By the time they got out of Sybil Brand, they were sharing smokes out of a common stash, and what bookkeeping there was no longer included nicotine. They took a place together in North Hollywood, where they could do what they wanted all day long and all night, too, which is the way things usually ran. It was possible to live cheap in those days, and it helped that the landlady had also been inside and honored sisterly obligations that a more uptight individual might not even have recognized. Soon they had a regular dealer who made house calls, and a cat named Anais, and were known up and down the Tahunga Wash as a couple of righteous chicks you could trust in just about any situation. Bambi, imagining that she was there to look out for her friend, Jade, closer to the edge of misadventure than she knew. Meantime,
on one of these voyages of self-discovery so common at that time, in the most intensely light-bearing complexities of some now-half-forgotten acid trip, Ashley, Jade, saw something about herself nobody else till then had seen. Of its essence somehow, as Doc had already somehow guessed, was cunnilingus. The era, she couldn't help noticing, was conveniently providing not only eager girls, but also sweetly passive long-haired boys every place she looked, eager to devote to her pussy the oral attention it had always deserved.
Which reminds me, how you doing down there, Dinas?
Huh? Oh. Well, to begin with...
Never mind.
Just be advised, boys, she said. You'll want to watch your step. 'Cause what I am is like a small diameter pearl of the Orient rolling around on the floor of late capitalism. Lowlives of all income levels may step on me now and then, but if they do, it'll be them who slip and fall, and on a good day break their ass, while the old pearl herself just goes a-rollin' on.
Spike's friend Farley had a dark room, and when the proof sheets were ready, Doc went by to have a look. Most of the contact prints were blank frames, from Dinas leaving the lens cap on, or drastically angled room fragments when he had accidentally tripped the shutter, as well as an embarrassing number of low-angle shots of micro-skirted groupies and miscellaneous drug-related lapses into sleep or silliness. The only shot Coy seemed to be in was a Last Supper-type grouping around a long table in the kitchen, with everybody in heated discussion over a number of pizzas. Coy was saturated in a funny, vibrant blur that didn't match any other part of the space, and watching the camera a little too intently, with an expression forever about to unfold into a smile.
"This one here," Doc said. "Could you make me an enlargement?"
"Sure," said Farley. 8x10 glossy okay?"
Reluctant, maybe even a little desperate, Doc figured he had to go visit Bigfoot now. On principle, he tried to spend as little time around the glass house as possible. It creeped him out, the way it just sat there looking so plastic and harmless among the old-time good intentions of all that downtown architecture, no more sinister than a chain motel by the freeway. And yet behind its neutral drapes and far away down its fluorescent corridors, it was swarming with all this strange alternate cop history and cop politics, cop dynasties, cop heroes and evildoers, saintly cops and psycho cops, cops too stupid to live and cops too smart for their own good, insulated by secret loyalties and codes of silence from the world they'd all been given to control, or, as they like to put it, protect and serve. Bigfoot's native element, the air he breathed. The big time he'd been so crazy to get away from the beach and be promoted into. At the desk in the lobby at Parker's Center, owing no doubt to what he'd been smoking since he hit the freeway, Doc let loose with a long and even to him not always coherent rap about how he usually didn't spend much time hanging out with elements of the criminal justice system, mostly getting his information from the L.A. Times. But how about that Leslie Van Houten, huh? So cute and yet so lethal. And what was the real angle on this Manson trial? 'Cause in a strange way, wasn't it something like this postseason the Lakers were having? And did he happen to catch that game with Phoenix? The sergeant nodded.
"That's 318.
Upstairs, Bigfoot, strangely jumpy today, seemed about to apologize for not having an office, even a cubicle of his own, though in fact, nobody else at Homicide had one either. Everybody milled around in a single oversized room with two long tables and chain-smoked and drank coffee out of paper cups and hollered into phones and sent out for tacos and burgers and fried chicken and so forth, and half of what they threw at the wastebaskets missed,
so there was an interesting texture to the floor, which Doc thought might once have included some vinyl tiling.
Given the semi-public surroundings, I hope this will not be another of these unabridged, paranoid, hippie monologues I seem increasingly obliged to sit through. Quickly as he could, Doc recapped what he knew about Coy Harlingen. The allegedly fatal OD, the mysterious addition to Hope's bank account, Coy pretending to be an agitator at the Nixon rally. He left out the part about talking to Coy in person.
Another case of apparent resurrection, Bigfoot shrugged. Not at first glance, a matter for homicide.
So, who around here would handle resurrections, man?
Bunko squad, usually.
Does that mean LAPD officially believes that every return from the dead is some kind of a con?
Not always. Could be a mistaken or false ID type of problem.
But not...
You're dead, you're dead. Are we talking philosophy?
Doc lit up a cool, reached in his fringe bag, and found Dinas's photo of Coy Harlingen.
What is this? Another rock and roll band? My kids wouldn't even have this on their wall.
That one there is the stiff in question.
And just remind me, why do I give a shit again?
He worked for the department as a snitch, not to mention for some patriotic badasses known as Vigilant California, who might or might not have been in on the raid at Channel View Estates. You remember that place? All them cute little kids jumping in the pools and so on?
All right. Bigfoot had another look at the picture. You know what? I'll go check into this personally.
But, Bigfoot, that isn't like you, Doc needled. It's a cold case. Where's there any glory in clearing one of them?
Sometimes it's about doing the right thing, replied Bigfoot, fluttering his eyelashes disingenuously.
He motioned Doc down a back corridor and into a utility room.
Just want to look in the freezer a minute.
It was a corpse-sized professional pathologist model from some years back, a hand-me-down from the coroner's office, and Doc, expecting to see homicide-related body parts, was surprised instead to find several hundred frozen chocolate-covered bananas inside.
Don't imagine for a minute I'm feeling nostalgic about the beach, Bigfoot was quick to protest. It's an addiction. I used to deny that, but my therapist says I've made amazing progress. Please, dig in, feel free. I'm told I have to share. We have the system of pneumatic message tubes here, routed all through the building, and I've been using it to send these babies everywhere it'll do some good.
Thanks. Doc reached out a frozen banana. Gee, Bigfoot, there certainly are a lot of these in here. Don't tell me the department's picking up the tab.
Actually, Bigfoot for the moment unable to look Doc in the eye, we get them free.
When cops say free, why do I get the feeling you're about to lay some moral dilemma on me here?
Maybe you could give me the hippie point of view, Sportello. It's been keeping me up nights.
Bigfoot had been driving around once a week to Cosmic Banana, a frozen banana shop near the Gordita Beach Pier, creeping in by way of the alley and back. It was a classic shakedown. Kevin, the owner, instead of throwing away the banana peels, was cashing in on a hippie belief of the moment by converting them to a smoking product he called Yellow Haze. Specially trained crews of speed freaks, kept out of sight nearby in a deserted resort hotel about to be demolished, worked three shifts, carefully scraping off the insides of the banana peels and obtaining, after oven drying and pulverizing it, a powdery black substance they wrapped in plastic bags to sell to the deluded and desperate. Some who smoked it reported psychedelic journeys to other places and times. Others came down with horrible nose, throat, and lung symptoms that lasted for weeks. The belief in psychedelic bananas went on, however, gleefully promoted by underground papers, which ran learned articles comparing diagrams of banana molecules to those of LSD, and including alleged excerpts from Indonesian professional journals about native cults of the banana and so forth, and Kevin was raking in thousands. Bigfoot saw no reason why law enforcement shouldn't be cut in for a share of the proceeds.
What kind of extortion do you call that? Doc wanted to know. Ain't like it's a real drug. It doesn't get you loaded. And anyway, it's legal, Bigfoot.
Exactly my point. If it's legal, then so is taking my cut. Especially, see, if it's in the form of frozen bananas instead of money.
But, Doc said, no, wait. Not logical, Captain. Something I can't quite...
He was still trying to figure it out by the time he got back to the beach. He found Spike sitting on the alleyway steps.
Something you might want to look at, Doc. Farley just got it back from the lab.
They went over to Farley's place. He had it threaded on a 16-millimeter projector, all set to screen. A sunny vista in ectochrome commercial of half-built ranch burgers and contractor hardpan is suddenly a swarm with men in matching camo fatigues, bought in lots from some local surplus store, also wearing ski masks, machine-knit and reindeer and cone-bearing tree motifs. They are packing some weird and heavy shit, among which Spike points out M16s and AK-47s, both original as well as knockoffs from different lands, Heckler and Koch machine guns in both belt and drum-fed designs, Uzis and repeating shotguns. The raiding parties splash across the flood control channel, secure the street bridges and footbridges, and set up a perimeter around the temporary mini-plaza, whose flagship tenant is Chick Planet Massage. Doc noticed his car parked out in front, but the motorcycles that were there when he arrived had vanished. The camera tilts up, and there, fleeing deeper into the tract or only riding around in circles, are Mickey's Badass Brigade on Harleys, Kawasaki Mach 3s, and, as Spike points out, a Triumph Bonneville T-120, with no clear idea of what their mission is anymore. It was weird to Doc watching now, weird beyond easy imagining, that somewhere inside the place, invisible, he was lying unconscious, that with an X-ray specs attachment of some kind, he could be looking at himself inert, next door to dead, and that viewing this film of an assault that was just about to begin might qualify as what Sortilege liked to call an out-of-body experience. Suddenly, on screen, all hell broke loose. Even though there was no soundtrack, Doc could hear it. Sort of. The frame started bouncing around as if Farley was trying to get to cover. The old bell and howl he was using shot 100 feet of film at a time, and then the reel had to be changed, so the coverage was a little jumpy. There were also 3 built-in turret lenses, long, normal, and wide-angle, that could be rotated as needed in front of the gate, often during the shot. The footage, almost too clearly, showed Glenn Sherlock getting shot down by one of the masked gunmen. There it was, the money shot. Glenn, unarmed, moving in some kind of prison yard crouch, trying to look bad, when all that really came through was the fear that owned him, and how much he didn't want to die. The light wasn't protecting him, not the way it will sometimes protect the actors in a movie, the way moviegoers have gotten used to. This wasn't studio light, only the indiscriminate L.A. sun. But somehow it was singling out Glenn, setting him apart as the one who would not be spared. The shooter was used to handling small arms in the dutiful way of a rifle range commando. No bravado, no shouting or abuse or firing from the crotch. He took his time. You could see him paying attention to his breath as he sighted Glenn. Let him. took him down with silent three-shot bursts, though several more than were needed.
"What about your lab?" Doc said, to say something. "They ever watch what they process?"
"Not too likely," Farley said. "They're used to me by now. Think I'm crazy."
"Can they run off an extra print? Maybe enlarge a frame or two? I'm wondering what's behind those masks."
"Resolution goes all to hell," Farley shrugged. "But I guess you could try."
Around lunchtime next day, the princess phone started jingling.
"Holy shit, Essay, you're real."
"At least one day a week. You must have lucked out. Who is this?"
"He forget me already. Sin vergüenza,
as my grandma would say." "Trick question, Luz. How you been, mi amor?"
"Your strange way of flirting."
"You're off today, I hope."
Close to the office, within walking distance, in fact, was a small ex-neighborhood, its houses all condemned for an airport extension, which may have existed only as some bureaucratic fantasy. Empty, but not deserted, exactly. Questionable movies were being shot inside. Drug and weapons drops were being made. Chicano bikers were having furtive noontime trysts with young Anglo executives in tax-deductible toupees that retained in their Dinell thatchwork the smell of bars downtown at lunchtime. Dopers were getting off on the airplanes a couple inches over their heads, and particularly unhappy area residents from PV to Point Dume were out scouting potential suicide sites. Luz showed up in a red SS-396 she kept saying she'd borrowed from her brother, though Doc thought he detected a boyfriend someplace in the subtext. She was wearing cut-off jeans, cowgirl boots, and a tiny T-shirt that matched the car. They found an empty house and went inside. Luz had brought a bottle of Cuervo. There was a queen-size mattress with cigarette burns in it, a French provincial floor model TV with the screen all kicked in, a number of empty 5-gallon joint compound containers that people had been using for picnic furniture.
"I see in the papers that Mickey's still missing."
"Even the FBI don't come around no more. Riggs split again for the desert, and Sloan and me, we've become very close."
"How, close would that be? That bed downstairs Mickey would never fuck me on? That's ours now."
What's this I'm looking at here?"
"Well, come on, it's an interesting thought, ain't it? The two of you. You guys and this lesbian thing. Why don't you just get comfortable down there?"
"No, I meant down there. And I'll tell you all the details."
Passenger jets came thundering in every couple of minutes. The house shook. Sometimes, when Luz parted her legs briefly, Doc thought he could hear landing gear tires rolling across the roof. The louder it got, the more excited she became.
"What happens if one comes in a little too low? We can be dead, right?"
She grabbed two handfuls of his hair and pushed his face away from her pussy.
"What's the matter, motherfucker? You can't hear me?"
Whatever he was going to say would have been drowned out in another deafening approach. And anyway, what Luz wanted now was to fuck, which is what they did. And after a while, they lit up a joint, and she was talking about Sloan.
"These English chicks, they get to Khalifa's, they don't know how to behave. They see these people, man, all this money and real estate, and none of them with any idea what to do with it. First thing anybody hears when we get across the border, esta gente no sabe nada."
So Sloan has all this resentment. Whenever she finds out about any piece of money that's there to be grabbed, she thinks she's the one that should have it. For Riggs, it's always more like, not that he should get it, but that some other asshole shouldn't.
What the he'd like to call theft. They might. Sloan likes to call it reallocation.
So, what was it? Her and Riggs were skimming off Mickey. Double billing his clients, stiffing his contractors, or what?
Luz shrugged.
Wasn't my business.
Did they just spend their time running different hustles, or did they at least fuck once in a while?
Riggs said it wasn't so much that he got to fuck her as that Mickey didn't.
Uh-huh. What did Riggs have against her husband?
Nothing. They were all compinches.
Riggs would never have gone near Sloane's pussy if Mickey hadn't encouraged him.
Mickey was gay?
Mickey fucked other women. He just wanted Sloane to have some fun, too. Him and Riggs worked together on different projects. Riggs stayed at the house when he was in town. Couldn't keep from jerking himself off any time Sloane was in the room. Seemed like a natural choice for Mickey to fix her up with. Along with the usual selling points. Big dick, young, poor enough to keep on some kind of a leash. Course, Sloane wasn't too hot for the idea at first, because she hated to owe Mickey for anything. But why are you so interested in this?
Carryings on of the rich and powerful. Better than reading The Inquirer. Plus, you don't get to fuck no newspaper, do you, my little Anglo hijo de puta?
Fuck, fuck, suggested Doc amiably.
Otra vez, see?
So he was a little late getting back to the office, and for days he would be making up explanations for all the visible hickeys and claw marks and so on. As Luz prepared to zoom away in the Supersport, Doc said, "One thing. What do you think really happened to Mickey?" She grew unflirtatious, almost somber. Her beauty deepening somehow.
I just hope he's alive, man.
He wasn't that bad of a person. Looking forward to a peaceful morning at the office, Doc had just lit up when the antique intercom started in with its guttural buzz. He moved a couple of Bakelite switches and heard somebody who might be Petunia downstairs yelling his name. This usually meant there was a visitor, most likely a chick, given the breathless interest Petunia maintained in Doc's social life.
"Thanks, Toon," Doc screamed back cordially. "Send her right on up. And did I mention, incidentally, your outfit this morning is especially striking? That daffodil shade picks up the color of your eyes." Knowing little if any of this would get through without heavy distortion.
On the off chance his unknown visitor might take a dim view of marijuana use, Doc ran around with a can of supermarket brand air freshener, filling the office with a horrible thick mist of synthetic floral notes. The door opened and in stepped this, have mercy, this incredible looker. Even with the reduced visibility and all, red hair, leather jacket, tiny little skirt, cigarette, stuck to a lower lip that looked more desirable the closer she got.
"Cootie food," Doc screamed involuntarily, having been told once that this was French for love at first sight.
"Remains to be seen," she said. "But what is this smell in here? It's fucking nauseating."
He looked at the label on the aerosol can.
"Wildflower whimsy."
A gas station toilet in Death Valley would be ashamed to smell like this.
"Meantime, I'm Clancy Sherlock."
She put her arm out full length, and they shook hands.
"Glenn Sherlock's..."
Doc began about the same time she said,
"Sister."
"Well, I'm sorry about your brother."
"Glenn was a shit, and bound to have his series canceled sometime. That don't keep me from wanting to know who his killer is."
"You talk to the police?"
"More like they talk to me. Some smartass named Bjornson. Can't say it was too encouraging. Would you mind not staring at my tits like that?"
"Who? Oh, must have been trying to read your t-shirt."
"It's like a picture. A Frank Zappa?"
"So it is. You say now, Lieutenant Bjornson referred you to me?"
He sounded a lot more concerned with Mickey Wolfman's disappearance than Glenn's murder, which, given LAPD's priority, is no big surprise, but I guess he's a fan of yours. She had been looking around the office, and her tone was doubtful. Excuse me, is that a half-smoked joint in your ashtray there?
Oh, frighteningly unsociable of me. Please, here's a new one, all ready to light, see?
If he was expecting a romantic smoke sequence along the lines of Now Voyager, 1942, this was not to be. Before he could raise a sophisticated eyebrow, Clancy had seized the joint, clanked open a Zippo, and fired it up. And by the time Doc got it back, it was less than half its original length.
Interesting shit, she remarked, when she finally got around to exhaling.
Then they had a prolonged and, for Doc, erectile moment of eye contact. Be professional now, he advised himself.
The theory downtown is that your brother tried to prevent whoever it was from putting the snatch on Wolfman and got shot for doing his job. Way too sentimental.
She had slid into the green and fuchsia lunchroom booth and had her elbows on the table. If there was a snatch in the works, Glenn was more likely to be in on it. Being paid for looking bad is fine, but any real trouble in Glenn's reflex was always to just split.
Then maybe he saw something he shouldn't have.
She nodded to herself for a while. Finally, well, yep, that's how Boris has it figured, too.
Who?
Another member of Mickey's Muscle Patrol. They've all dropped out of sight, but last night Boris called me late. We have some history. To look at him, he's nobody you'd want to get agitated, but I can tell you, right now, he's scared shitless.
What of?
He wouldn't say.
Think he'd talk to me?
Worth a try.
There's the phone.
Hey, a princess phone, man. I used to have one of these. I mean, mine was pink, but poison green is nice, too. Were you planning to marry that joint, or just keep hanging on to it? The phone had a long cord, and Clancy took it as far away from Doc as she could. Doc went in the toilet and became absorbed in something by Louis L'Amour he'd forgotten was in there. The next thing he knew, Clancy was hammering on the door.
Boris says it's got to be in person.
That night, Doc met Clancy after she got off work tending bar in Inglewood, and they drove out to a biker's roadhouse somewhere off the harbor freeway called Knucklehead Jack's. As they came in the door, the jukebox was playing the Del Shannon perennial Runaway, which Doc took to be a hopeful sign. The low oxygen level inside was more than made up for by smoke of various national origins. Boris Spivey had the dimensions, if possibly not the self-restraint, of an NFL lineman. The pool cue in his hand looked about the size of Baton does in Zubin Mehta's.
Clancy said they popped you for Glenn.
They had to cut me loose. Wrong place at the wrong time was all. Found unconscious at the scene, so forth. I still don't know what happened.
Me neither. I was out in Pico Rivera, visiting my fiancée, Dawnette. You play pool? How do you feel about masse shots?
The usual love-hate.
I'll break.
The pool table was host for a while to squirming ball trajectories, its playing surface repeatedly threatened by steeply driven cue angles, till Mrs. Pixley, the owner, finally made her way over to Doc and Boris, bearing a grim smile and a sawed-off shotgun, and a hush fell on the place.
See that sign over the bar, fellas? You can't read it? I'll be happy to.
Oh, come on, we ain't hurting nothing. I don't care, you and your little playmate are gonna have to leave the premises now. Ain't so much the cost of replacing the felt. I just personally fucking hate masse shots.
Doc looked around for Clancy
and saw her over in a booth, deep in conversation with two motorcyclists of a sort mothers tend not to approve of.
"She can take care of herself, okay," Boris said. "She's always been into two at a time, and this looks like her lucky night. Come on, my truck's out in the lot."
His head, now unavoidably teeming with lewd images, Doc followed Boris out to a 46 Dodge Power Wagon with a mottled paint job of olive drab and primer coat gray. They climbed in, and Boris sat checking the lot out for a while.
"You think we convinced him back there? I figure a guy can't ever be too paranoid."
"How heavy is this that we're talking about?" Doc, lighting them a couple of cools.
"Tell me, compadre, just between us, you ever kill anybody?"
"Self-defense, all the time. On purpose? Hey, who can remember? How about yourself?"
"You packing right now?"
"Were we expecting company?"
"After a certain amount of time on the special needs yard," explained Boris, "you gain the impression that there is always somebody looking to ice your ass."
Doc nodded. "Thing about these hippie get-ups," lifting one bell-bottom cuff to reveal a little short-barrel Model 27, "is you can almost fit a heckler and coke under here if you want."
"You're a dangerous hombre, I can see that. Too dangerous for me, so I guess I better just spill the whole thing."
Doc got ready to jump out and run, but Boris only continued.
"Truth is, Glenn got done in cold blood. He wasn't supposed to be there when they came for Mickey. The fix was in. Puck Beaverton had the duty that day. Plan was to let them in the door and then disappear. But Puck got cold feet at the last minute and changed shifts with Glenn. Except he didn't tell Glenn what was going to happen. He just split."
"This Puck guy, you know where he went?"
"Probably Vegas. Puck thinks there's people there who look after him."
"Sure would have liked a word with him. Whole thing's kind of puzzling. Let's say, for example, that Mickey was in trouble."
"Trouble ain't a word. This was the deepest shit he could get in. All because of this idea that came to him. All the money he ever made, he was working on a way to just give it back."
Doc exhaled more than whistled through his teeth. "Can I still get my name on the list?"
"You think I'm bullshitting? That's okay. We all thought Mickey was, too."
"Yeah, but why would he—"
"Don't ask me. Wouldn't be the first rich guy on a guilt trip lately. He was doing a lot of acid, some peyote. Maybe it just got to a point. You must have seen that happen."
"Once or twice. But it's more like calling in sick for a couple days. Breaking up with your old lady. Nothing on that scale."
"What Mickey said was, 'I wish I could undo what I did. I know I can't. But I bet I can make the money start to flow in a different direction.'"
"He told you that?"
"Heard him say it. Him and his chick Shasta had a few of those intimate discussions. I wasn't trying to listen in or nothing, just happened to be there, price of being invisible. Shasta, she thought Mickey was crazy, wanting to give all his money away. For some reason it scared her. He started in needling, like all she was worried about was losing her meal ticket. Which really was crazy, because she was in love with him, man. If she was scared for anybody, it was for him. I don't know if Mickey ever believed it, but every jailbird that's been in, even for a night, can tell the difference between the hustles you put on somebody you want to fuck and that other thing, that longing. All you had to do was look in her face."
They sat smoking. "Shasta and I lived together for a short while," Doc thought he should mention. "And I can't say I ever knew how she felt about me, how deep it went."
"Man," Boris glancing quickly down in the direction of Doc's ankle rig, "I hope this ain't a bummer for you to be hearing this."
"Boris,
I only look like an evil motherfucker. Secretly, I'm as sentimental as any ex-old man. Please forget the Smith. Just tell me. Who else do you think was worried about Mickey's big giveaway? Business partners? The wife?
Sloan? He wasn't telling her shit. Not till it's over and done and lawyer-proof, is what he kept saying.
Also said, if she ever found out too soon, the California Bar Association would declare a day of thanksgiving for all the new business.
But he'd have to bring in lawyers himself at some point. Nobody just hands out millions. He would have needed some technical help.
All's I know is there was suddenly an army of guys in suits around Mickey's place. Only kind I can ID on sight is Mormons and FBI, if there's a difference. And I'm still not too sure what these were.
You think they could have been some of Sloan's people, like she found out anyway, or began to pick up funny vibes? And how about her boyfriend, that Riggs guy?
Yeah. Shasta thought Sloan and him were cooking up something together. She was nervous already. But then she started to get really freaked. Mickey was renting a place for her up in Hancock Park. Sometimes when I was off shift, I'd drop by. Nothing romantic, understand. Just you could tell how much safer she felt with somebody around. Every day there was something new. Cars cruising the house, phone calls that nobody on the other end would say anything, people tailing her whenever she went out in the El Dorado.
She happened to get any license numbers?
Figured you'd ask.
Boris took out his wallet and found a folded wheat straw cigarette paper and handed it to Doc.
Hope you got a way to run these without the cops knowing.
Guy I used to work for has this computer. Why don't you want to go through the LAPD? Seems like they'd be looking to get whoever it is, too.
What are you a doctor of, tripping? University of what planet again?
Almost sounds like maybe you think LAPD's in on this.
No fucking maybe. And Mickey was getting warned enough, too. Cop friend of his kept showing up at the house all the time.
Let me guess. Blonde, Swedish, talks weird sometimes, answers to the name Bigfoot?
That's him. I think it was Sloan he kept coming around for, you really want to know.
But he warned Mickey to, what? Stay away from Chick Planet Massage? Don't trust your bodyguards?
Whatever. Mickey ignored all the advice. He liked it out there at Channel View, and especially that massage joint. Last place any of us expected a raid on. One minute we're getting a nice blowjob, the next it's like fucking Vietnam. Assault teams every place you look. Scuba units climbing out of the jacuzzi. Chicks running around screaming.
Wow. Almost sounds like you were there on the scene, and not out on Pico Rivera.
Okay, okay, I did drop by for a second. Just to pick up some of that purple shit Donette likes, that you pour it in the bathtub. It makes bubbles.
Bubble bath?
That's it. And just walked right in the middle of everything. But wait, you said you were there too, all that time, unconscious or whatever. So how come I didn't see you?
Maybe I was really out in Pico Rivera.
Long as you weren't messing with my fiancée.
They sat regarding each other quizzically.
Donette, Doc said.
The characteristic long-stroke reverb of a Harley Road machine approached. It was one of Clancy's dates for the evening, with Clancy riding behind him.
Everything okay?
She called, though not exactly with keen interest.
Boris cranked down his window and leaned out. This guy is freaking me out here, Clance. Where do you find such heavy-duty hombres at?
Call you soon, Doc,
Clancy sort of drawled out. Doc, remembering the old Roy Rogers song, came back with four bars of Happy Trails to You, as Clancy and her new friend Aubrey thundered on out of the lot. Aubrey, waving a gauntleted hand, to be followed shortly by his coadjutor, Thorndike, on an electric glide shovelhead.
Chapter 10 Back at the beach, Doc collapsed on his couch and drifted towards sleep. But scarcely had he penetrated the surface tension and sunk into REM than the